dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this week,
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The program this week, I mean to be part of a series to confront the question, what is the economy for? Who was our economic system for? Should it be saved, or is it fundamentally misguided in that it discounts or destroys the things that matter and elevates and values the shallow, the cruel, and the repugnant? The discourse surrounding this question, even by those who mean well, often takes for granted certain criteria that are not defined. For example, we hear in mainstream discussion of concepts like efficiency and productivity, without the speakers adding the important question, from whose perspective is something efficient or productive? What is it productive of? Banality? Ugly buildings? Mind-numbing employment, a poisoned environment, ignorance, poorly made junk, desperation and fear, disrespect and contempt, pettiness and confusion, lies and propaganda? In what way is the system efficient when there are millions of homeless people and millions of empty homes? Why should any human being have to ask permission of another human being to go to the bathroom? This is a situation faced by many people in the jobs they're forced to take, rather than starve. My first official experience in employment at age 16 was working at a business that sold pantyhose through the mail. I was one of a group of people that sat in a large room under the watchful eyes of a supervisor, removing money and order forms from envelopes. We were made to wear a plastic smock over our clothes. We were not permitted to talk. A radio station chosen by some manager played relentlessly. And we were not permitted to visit the bathroom without raising our hands to ask permission. This degrading treatment was no doubt justified in the name of efficiency and profitability. Much has been made of the executive bonuses of Wall Street firms receiving bailouts. But to me, there is a more fundamental question that I have never heard anyone mention in a congressional hearing. The fact that no executive is ever compelled to ask permission to go to the bathroom, nor does anyone in the position to make rules that others are compelled to obey ever subject themselves to the level of degradation they inflict on others. Therefore, on the question of what is efficient, if this were an actual free society, no one would tolerate working under such conditions because they would not be efficient at providing happiness and self-esteem. If pantyhose or anything else can't be provided without degrading treatment or destroying the environment, then to hell with it. Or as they say, take your jobs and shove them. This system is so ethically and imaginatively bankrupt that people now find themselves in the bizarre position of clamoring to save the very jobs they hate to go to every single day. Any society in which people don't set for themselves the terms of how they work, when they work, and what they work on is not a free society. I submit to you that no person who has not been either brainwashed or coerced would accept this. The religion of the market is as delusional a fundamentalism as any you would care to name. In what efficient system would farmers producing wonderful food be so poor that they qualify for food stamps, while others become insanely rich producing credit default swaps? The economics and politics of food is the subject of the first hour, with a new talk from one of my favorite people, Vandana Shiva. In the second hour, I'm going to play you something very special to me. March 31st is the 9-year anniversary of this show. On the very first broadcast of Unwelcome Guests, I played a radio adaptation done by my friend Mariah Gallardin of TUC Radio of a documentary, Who's Counting?, on the work of the feminist economist Marilyn Waring. Her critique of the economic system and the politics that support it is the essence of the vision that motivated me to do this radio show. And the past 9 years has been an effort on my part to present evidence and analysis to buttress the view that the corporate world order not only must end, but can end. I'd been thinking of reprising that piece from my first broadcast, since few people who now listen had ever heard it in those years. Then an amazing thing happened. Mariah, independently from me, updated that very same broadcast for her current offering of TUC Radio. Talk about a message from the universe. So we'll hear that in the second hour. I have a favor to ask of you as well. I'd really like to hear from you with some feedback about the show. 9 years is a very long time to do something, and I don't hear from many people who listen. I would be absolutely delighted if you would email me at unwelcome@radioforall.net. And that's radio, the number 4, ALL.net. So let's get on with Vandana Shiva. The talk comes to us courtesy of Voices for Global Justice. Mansoor Saba will give the introduction.
Dr. Vandana Shiva is a renowned physicist, philosopher, ecofeminist, and environmental activist. She specializes in the effects of global trade on agriculture and culture. She's also a key figure in the global solidarity movement known as Alter Globalization. Internationally, Dr. Shiva has advised both governmental and non-governmental organizations on issues such as biodiversity, bioethics, sustainable agriculture, and water supply. Dr. Shiva has written several books, including Water Wars, Stolen Harvest, and her latest, Soil Not War, Environmental Justice in a Time of Climate Crisis. Vandana Shiva gave a lecture on sustainability and the world food crisis at the University of Southern California on March 9, 2008.
Thank you for organizing this event and for inviting me here. In a way, the issues and the themes you've kind of chosen to announce are a synthesis of the work I've been doing at the ecological level for 35 years and in terms of sustainable agriculture for 25 years. Normally, when people think of the world food crisis, they think about the rise in food prices, which, of course, is a huge crisis for those who are denied their right to food, people who are anyway eating half of what they should be eating, and now they eat a quarter. Or the billion people who were already hungry, to that gets added 200 million in the last year alone. In 1 year, 200 million additional people were added. And the projections are that if this level of deprivation continues from 2009 to 2015, between 1.4 to 2.8 million people would die for lack of access to food. Lack of food is not a state of nature. You know, every species gets food. The microbes in the soil get their food. The birds get their food. The bees used to get food. Poor things are being denied too with the pesticides and the colony collapse disorder. But human beings have managed through a strange kind of intelligence to create a system in which 1 billion people go without food and 2 billion people are cursed with bad food. And the curse of bad food, to me, is as serious a part of the world food crisis as the denial of the right to food. This morning, they brought me my breakfast, and I couldn't eat the potatoes. They were tasteless. They were pure starch. Now, if you've tasted real potatoes out of your organic farm, and you know there should be a taste in potatoes, pure starch is difficult to swallow. And, you know, they're now breeding potatoes in such a way that the same potato could be used for structures, for making chairs, and for feeding people. Now, can you imagine what a mess that has to be? Because hunger is not a state of nature, hunger is created. Now, the normal narrative of hunger is people in the third world are hungry because either they're lazy or they're stupid or they don't have smart technologies. And somehow, if more chemicals were spread in the world or more fossil fuels were used for agriculture, magically you'd have more food. No. If you have more chemicals in farming, you have more toxics. You don't get more food. If you use more fossil fuels in farming, you get more greenhouse gases. You don't get more food. And I don't know why the basic science of what makes food has increasingly been displaced by a scientific mythology. It parades as science, but it's not science, which has systematically, through the very seeking of increasing food production, actually created more hunger in the world. Agriculture used to be women's domain. Women domesticated species. Women were the leaders of creating agriculture. And to the extent that agriculture and food was in women's hand, you know, you might have had hunger for a short time because there was a war, a bad drought, famine. But the system itself did not generate the scarcity. The conditions and context for scarcity came from somewhere else. Industrial agriculture and globalized agriculture is actually creating scarcity. It's creating food scarcity. And it's creating a deprivation of hunger. And a lot of my work has been addressed to the myth that chemical farming, called the Green Revolution in the Third World, has increased food production, or industrial agriculture is a more productive enterprise than ecological farming. Let me just run through some figures. It takes 10 times more energy in an industrial system to produce a calorie of food. You know, you use 10 calories of energy as input and you get out 1 calorie of food. That's a negative economy. And then if you add to it the fact that, especially in this country, food has been reduced to meat and meat has been reduced to factory farms, you have an additional conversion of 10 times food fed to the cattle as feed gives you 1 unit of food as animal protein. So at every step, we have a decline of a factor of 10. And we call that increasing productivity. There's a very simple definition, those of you who've done anything related to productivity, it's output per unit input. The higher your input, the lower your productivity. Industrial agriculture is, by its very definition and nature, a high input system. And it has grown with the illusion that the more food is being produced, but the reality of it is there are interests who would like to turn agriculture into a consumption of chemicals, a consumption of fossil fuels. It becomes a new market. We used to have chemicals restricted to war. And after the wars were over, those who had got used to selling chemicals worked very hard to find their application in agriculture. 2 very good books that show this connection, that agrochemicals, the external inputs in farming, are actually war chemicals. One book written in 1930 by a person who was sent to India as an imperial agriculturist. They didn't have the word agriculturists in those days. They used to call them economic botanists. And he was sent to introduce chemicals into Indian farming and improve Indian agriculture. His name is Sir Albert Howard. He's today known as the father of modern organic farming. And in a book he wrote, which is called The Agricultural Testament, he's written very, very clearly that I arrived in India, found the soils fertile, found no pests in the field. I threw away my spray gun and decided to turn the peasant and the pest into my teachers. Out of it came his learning on organic. Out of his learning on organic, and by the way, his learning on organic was also his wife's learning on organic, because Albert Howard and his wife always worked together. They were a wonderful team in wheat breeding, in organic farming. It's his work that led to the creation of the Rodale Research Institute. The grandfather of the current Rodale met Howard and then started all the experiments that have led to the organic initiatives here. And in UK, the organic movement called the Soil Association, the Soil Association too was inspired by Howard's work, which was in turn Howard inspired by the Indian agriculture, inspired by the Indian peasant. I'm not having the Dasani because I took a pledge with my friends in the Coca-Cola movement. I'll never touch it. So. And he says in the book, vested interests that had got used to making profits during the war could not give up their addiction. And then they brought the chemical. Fertilizers came out of the war industry that made explosives, and the chemical pesticides are directly designed to kill people, which is what we saw when in 1984 a pesticide plant in the city of Bhopal leaked in the middle of the night, December, cold night, and 3,000 people were killed instantaneously with the poison that leaked from there, and 30,000 people have died since then. Well, 1984 was really the year that kind of pushed me into looking at something was wrong with agriculture. It was also the year we had huge violence in Punjab. And on the 4th of June, I think it was, the Golden Temple, the most sacred shrine of the Sikhs, was invaded by the Indian army because extremists was hiding in there. But this extremist had been cultivated by the central government, just like Bin Laden was cultivated by the Americans to fight the Soviets. You know, and that was the beginning of the whole creation of the Taliban. Bhindarwale was made to grow in order to counter the Akalis, who are the popular party of Punjab. Punjab is where the Green Revolution was introduced. And the Green Revolution was given a Nobel Peace Prize on the thesis that it would create so much prosperity, everyone would be rich, and no one would ever become a revolutionary. Now, green in 1965 did not mean green as sustainable. Green in 1965, when the Green Revolution was introduced, only meant a color different from red. And red was what was happening in China. And the US was very keen that India should not go the China way. Of course, the interesting thing is with the kind of development that's happening, larger and larger pockets of India are going the China way with globalization, depriving people of their resources, their rights to land, their rights to livelihood. Anyway, the Green Revolution gets brought to Punjab. In the early stages, it doesn't do too badly because there are huge subsidies. The fertilizers come for as good as free. The pesticide comes for free. The seeds are given. But over time, the fertilizers subsidies get withdrawn, and the addiction increases because these are ecological narcotics. The more urea you apply, the more you must apply. The more pesticides you spray, the more you must spray. And it's wonderful for the industry that sells these. I would say that the agrochemical industry is to the planet what drug traffickers are in society, because they sell toxic, lethal drugs that are killing the land and killing people, and do it through an addiction. And the addiction comes with, the first dose is always for free. It comes with a subsidy. Including seeds, non-renewable seeds are never introduced in a market phenomena. The first bit is said, you know, brilliant. But in the first, you give up your new renewable seeds, you got non-renewable seeds, next year you have to buy. Brilliant mechanisms. And very quickly, before we knew it, at the global level, food that used to be women's expertise has now become controlled by a war industry. A war industry controls our food system. And that war industry then has created all this manufacturing of the chemical sort of delivery through chemicals. DDT is good for you. I don't know how many of you have seen pesticide ads, as if everything in the world is going to devour you. Biodiversity is your enemy. And you've got to kill every bug, you've got to kill every insect, and then you'll be safe. Of course, you're not, because the pesticides themselves are the danger. The state of Punjab, and I wrote a book on this, I did it for the United Nations, it's called The Violence of the Green Revolution. By the end of it, I said, this is not about peace. It's violence to the land, it's violence to people, it's violence to human beings. Now from Punjab, we have a daily train, it's called the cancer train. Half of the people who travel that train are cancer patients who are going to a charitable hospital, because who can afford a cancer treatment? But there's a charitable hospital in Rajasthan to which they go. And this train from Punjab to Bikaner, it's called the cancer train. That's the popular name of the train. Every second person has cancer. And that will be the consequence of pumping poisons on your fields, getting farmers into debt, poisoning your groundwater, because all those poisons eventually end up in your groundwater and every day you're drinking them. And then the food that lands up in the food distribution system is also poison. I remember on one of my trips to Punjab more recently, I passed a farmer, old farmer who was carrying a big pesticide spray can. So I stopped and I looked at the labeling and nothing in the labeling said that this was poison. In fact, the word given to it in third world countries is medicine in local language. Pesticide is sold as medicine. So I asked this farmer, I said, did he know what he was carrying and what he was spraying? And he said, yeah, medicine. So I told him what it was, and it was the same carbaryl pesticide that had leaked in Bhopal. And I told him what it does. And this old man said, oh, now I understand why I get dizzy when I spray. But the second sentence was even more touching. And now I understand why the mango trees in our villages have stopped giving fruit. Because the pollinators have all been killed. And now there's no mango flowering. The collapse and disappearance of the bees has become a very big subject now, but it begins with the poisons in our farming systems. And now the poison story is kind of getting to a deeper level. And that deeper level is the fact that whereas the war industry and the chemical industry earlier used to spray poisons from the outside, now it is putting poisons inside plants. And this is what genetic engineering does. Again, just like for the Green Revolution, the story was more food, less hunger. In the case of genetic engineering, the story is more food. Way out of hunger is genetically engineered crops. You know, every article in any popular media will tell you that. You need genetic engineering in order to feed the world. Well, in the 20 years of commercialization, you have only two kinds of traits that have been evolved through genetic engineering. One is a trait of putting a gene into the plant that makes the plant resistant to that company's herbicide. So now the company can sell more herbicide, and the plants will survive the contamination of herbicide, and the farmer will have to buy both the herbicide and the seed from the same company. They even have contracts in which you can't buy your chemicals from any other company. And of course, a herbicide-resistant plant means, you know, just more spraying of herbicides, more spraying of poisons. The second application and the second category of genetic engineering is called Bt crops. Now, Bt comes from a soil organism called Bacillus thuringiensis. In the soil, it has safeguards because it only becomes toxic in the guts of a caterpillar family of insects. The caterpillar has certain enzymes which turn this prototoxin and endotoxin into a ready-made toxin. But in the plant, the gene produces a ready-made active toxin, which now starts to affect other things. Animals grazing on Bt cotton fields in India are dying. Autopsies done show that they haven't been able to digest the biomass. Our institute has just completed a study on the soil, and we didn't even imagine impact would be as serious as it is. Since this toxin now, as I mentioned, is a broad-spectrum toxin, and it's being released from every cell of the plant at every moment, in the root zone, in the leaves, in the pollen, in the Bt cotton fields, we found a disappearance of 17% of the microorganism that digest the organic matter and turn it into humus, the bacteria that are responsible for biodegradation. 26% of the disappearance of enzymes that allow the plant to take up phosphates. Because it's not that you can put phosphates and the plant takes it up. There's mediation through all kinds of fungi and enzymes and bacteria. There's an amazing ecosystem down there in the soil. And nitrogen fixing requires soil organisms. 22% of those soil organisms have been killed in the 3 years of planting of Bt cotton in a certain area. Now, on that rate, 10 years, you've got dead soils, because soils are living because of the life in the soil. There is more life in the soil than there is more life above the soil. There's more diversity in the soil than all the diversity of plants above the soil, or all the diversity of marine ecosystems. It's the least studied, least understood biodiversity on this planet. But it's not just the soils and animals that are being killed. One of the issues that has preoccupied me a lot is the issue of farmers' suicides. We never had farmers committing suicide in our area. In fact, when they brought the Green Revolution, the writings of the American experts used to be, oh, Indian farmers are fatalists. They accept anything. You can't push them into feeling that, you know, they're lacking in something. You can't make them feel they need something additional. It's a very satisfied community. In the last 10 years, since globalization started to change our agriculture, and since industrial chemical agriculture was expanded and genetic engineering was introduced, we've had 200,000 farmer suicides in 10 years. How does globalization get linked to it? There's an agreement in WTO called the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Agreement, and Monsanto, which is one of these big war chemical industries that today controls most of the seed supply of the planet. They have bought most local seed companies in India, in America, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Europe. They have recently bought up the biggest vegetable seed company, and therefore are now starting to do genetic engineering of vegetables, and we have this campaign on our wonderful eggplant, saying no to BT eggplant. Now, this agreement is many things, you know. It contains issues of software, so that Microsoft gets to sell you a program and you can't borrow from your neighbor or your friend. In Peru, they actually sent IPR police into university dorms to check the computers of every student to make sure they had the purchased software and not the borrowed software, which is what makes the open source software movement so important. It also has, and this agreement is also the things about Mickey Mouse, you know? I mean, it doesn't say Mickey Mouse, but Disney was part of the influence on this agreement. They had created an intellectual property committee that wrote the agreement. And as Monsanto says on record through its representative, James Enyart, in designing this agreement, we were the patient, diagnostician, physician all in one. We defined a problem, and according to them, the problem was that farmers save seeds. In every culture, throughout human history, the ethics has been seed cannot be destroyed. You cannot eat the seed. So you have story after story in every culture of how people died of hunger, but the seed was never touched. The story from my region, how in the mountain areas, I come from the Himalayan mountains where Chipko started, the people died of hunger, but the seed bins were packed. You have to save the seed for the future. But that is now a problem for seed monopolies. If seed can be saved, grown, multiplied, shared, where do you make your money? So you create legal systems and you create technological systems so that seed cannot be saved and reproduced. The legal system is the intellectual property system, the patent system. If you have a patent on something, then nobody else can have that thing without paying you a royalty. You know, the Audio Technica made this equipment here. It's fine they made this equipment because some other industry will make that equipment and they'll pay a license if this is patented. But in the case of seed, the industry doesn't create seeds. Industry does not create life forms. the best they can do is manipulate the life form. But manipulation is not creation. Putting toxins into a plant is not creating that plant. It's polluting that plant. It's hurting that plant. And this myth of creation has led to patenting of seed. When Monsanto has a patent, then a farmer saving seed is a thief. A farmer exchanging seed with a neighbor is a thief. And so the problem they defined was seed saving, and the solution they offered was patenting. Totally illegitimate. Illegitimate on justice grounds, sustainability grounds, but also on patent grounds, because you're giving a patent to something that's not patentable. And I've been very much part of this whole, you know, in all the work I do, the movement I started called Navdanya 21 years ago, is because of these issues. That we have to have seed that is not monopolized. We have to have seed that is not genetically modified. We have to have seed that is diverse. That is a vital part of creating food and agriculture security, because the first link in the food chain is the seed. And everything else gets shaped by what the seed is like. If it's genetically modified, you get genetically modified food. If it's engineered to respond to chemicals, as in the Green Revolution, you get more chemicals in your food, you get more pesticide residues. The seed determines what food you have. It also determines who will grow the food. It determines how you will have entitlement to it. And to make that monopoly complete, there's a second agreement of WTO. That is the agriculture agreement. Now, I call the TRIPS agreement the Monsanto agreement, and I call the agriculture agreement the Cargill agreement. How many of you know Cargill? How many of you are aware that Cargill exists? Well, not all of you. They control 70% of the world food supply. Cargill officials were deputed to be the U.S. trade representatives to write this treaty and impose it on the world. And this agriculture agreement is not about agriculture. It's about destroying agriculture, it's about destroying food security, and granting Cargill, ADM, ConAgra access to every market of the world. That is how we had the food crisis of last year. Because India, for example, grows enough food for itself. But if we are forced to import, and we've been forced to import through the WTO, when we are forced to import, behind the U.S. exports are huge subsidies. The rich countries give $400 billion subsidies. You know, you've just had a series of bailouts for banks and the automotive industry. But since chemical industrial agriculture started, there has been an every year bailout of what I would call the war industry, the industrial agriculture industry. Every year they've been bailed out on the world scale by $400 billion. Without it, it won't work. Because remember I said it needs 10 times more finance, 10 times more energy, 10 times more inputs. Then you get out of it. You can only sustain a negative system like that by bringing down the price. And that price is brought down through subsidies. And the subsidy structure then ends up being used to force other countries like mine to import. That's why I've called free trade is not free trade. WTO is not about free trade. It's about forced trade. It's about forcing you to buy what you don't need. And all this is done through the measure of opening up borders and the subsidy question. Let me come back to the cotton issue. Since Monsanto, you know, through TRIPS, Monsanto got an access to the Indian seed market. And today they are a monopoly. They have licensing arrangement with every Indian seed company. Every time you buy a BT product, you are buying a Monsanto product. The royalties are going to them. And the price difference is so huge. India is one of the areas where cotton was domesticated. And this basically means we have lots of varieties of cotton. We used to have 1,500 varieties of cotton. We had blue cotton and pink cotton and brown cotton and green cotton, and we had perennial cottons, and most of our cottons used to always grow as an intercrop. You know, you have cotton, but you have food. Over time, you know, in the last 15 years, it was first shifted to hybrids and now to BT cotton. BT cotton must be a monoculture, so it drives out the food. but it's also very vulnerable to pest attacks, even though it's supposed to be about controlling the bollworm, but it's creating new pests, and the bollworm is getting resistant. In the same 3 years while the soil was being killed, we've just done a survey of how much more pesticides farmers are using, because all of Monsanto's calculations are farmers are using no pesticides anymore. But we happen to work in these areas. So we just go door to door, ask the farmers, how much more are you using? 13 times higher levels of pesticide use today. So you take seed, which used to be 7 rupees a kilo if you bought it, and has become 17,000 rupees a kilo. Then you take a 13-fold increase in pesticide use and chemical fertilizers and irrigation systems and groundwater mining. You add it all up. Within a year, a farmer has got into a debt of 40,000, 50,000. Meantime, 25,000 farms in this country, all of which owned by agribusiness, cotton farms are not family farms, 25,000 farms are collecting $4 billion of subsidies to reduce the price of cotton to half, then dump it on us. So a farmer is spending 10 times more on inputs, and the product is getting one-third or half the price that they used to get. And you can see this means dead end. That is why farmers are committing suicide. The combination of monopolies on seeds married to chemicals and a deceptive market based on subsidies that constantly lowers the price for farmers, and by lowering the price for farmers doesn't allow people to make a living or have a life. One of the biggest reasons for world hunger, in my view, is the fact that the growers of food today are spending more money growing the food, borrowing, than they can ever pay back through what they have grown. The second aspect of this issue linked to the increasing control of corporations on agriculture, and even more now through globalization, which has meant industrialization spreads worldwide. When the same agribusiness sells inputs to the farmer, it's very high cost. Then it buys from the farmers at very low prices. And then it sells through trading systems the produce again at high prices. So they make money 3 times over. Yeah, at the input level, at the buying cheap from farmers and selling dear in the market. And the concentration has meant that the polarization is deeper between what a farmer gets and what people pay. But since the farmer is selling off everything he or she has grown to pay for the debt for the chemicals and seeds, when the farmer sells, they will sell it at 1/4 the price. And when they have to go buy the same thing, because the farmer must eat also, then they go borrow a second time over, but they can only borrow 1/4 of what they had grown. So systematically, food consumption levels are coming down. If a farmer grows rice, he'll probably sell it at 2 or 3 rupees a kilo, and then he goes to buy it, it's about 10 rupees a kilo. And because of this bondage created through costly inputs, and it is a slave system. In fact, the Punjab uprising of 1980s was the farmers declaring we are in a slave system. And that slave system means farmers are totally locked into debt. One option is leave the land, foreclosure. Second option is end your life. But a world without farmers is a world without food. And that is the real food crisis, that the farmers are being wiped out from across the world. In this country, the disappearance of farming has taken place over the last 50 years. In my country, it's taken place over the last 10 years. But the figures are so low for the United States now, 2% of people, or less than 2% on the land. You don't even have a census count anymore. There are more people in the prisons than there are on the farms. And that's partly because there's more thinking about how money can be made out of prisons than to keep farmers alive. There is another aspect of this food crisis, which is a silent crisis, and that is linked to what I said about about the disease epidemic industrial food is creating. We've constantly been told industrial agriculture produces more food. I've been working with biodiversity. The movement I built, Navdani, is about biodiversity. We grow lots of biodiversity. We save old seeds. We grow them out. We pack our farms. Our farm, Navdani's farm, grows 1,000 crop varieties. Our members grow 2,500 varieties. Most places of the world where women still control the farming and decide what will be grown, the results have been higher levels of productivity and higher levels of diversity. Let me just read out a few. A Nigerian home garden, women plant 57 species. Sub-Saharan Africa, which in the world's mind is an area that has no food, 120 different plants are grown alongside the cash crops, and it's the women who manage all these diversity. In Guatemala, home gardens of less than 0.1 hectare will have more than 10 trees and diverse crop species. In a single African home garden, more than 60 species of food-producing trees were counted. In Thailand, 230 food-producing species are counted. Home gardens run by women in Nigeria produce more food than the rest of the land that is being cultivated through large-scale methods of mechanization and chemical inputs. That is how food security was ensured, through diversity, which produces higher levels of output of nutrition per acre. And I think the real thing we should be measuring is not a yield of a commodity, but the nutrition of the food basket. And as long as food was in women's hands, it was about nutrition, it was about feeding the family, the community. As agriculture has become about profit-seeking, food has become a commodity. A commodity is neither nourishing anymore, because the nature has changed, like the potato, which makes furniture one day and feeds us the next day. It's being increasingly emptied of its nutritional value. Not only do you have less nutrition because you have a monoculture that has made the diversity of nutrition disappear, but you have lesser nutrition because your food itself is empty of nutrition. I have called it empty mass. It's empty of nutrition and loaded with toxins. A UK study has shown that between 1940 to 1991, vegetable had lost on an average 24% of their magnesium, 46% of their calcium, 27% of their iron, and no less than 76% of their copper. Now, magnesium is vital to attention. It's vital to maintaining concentration. And there has been a feeding program in England where an organic chef, Oliver something, he fed organic food in the schools, and these kids who could not sit still and had such high levels of attention deficit disorder started to calm down, because the organic food has all the nutrients. It's not empty food, and magnesium was being supplied. Scientists I've talked to have said that it's the lack of calcium in the food that is actually one of the contributing factors to obesity, because calcium is a gatekeeper, and it allows the body to release fat and release energy. But when you don't have adequate calcium, your gate is shut. And the body does not know how to release the fat and energy anymore. Basically, obesity is a result of totally devastating the metabolism through which the body regulates itself. This body is a miracle. It's a self-organizing miracle. With the intelligence of scales we haven't even begun to understand. Every cell knows what to do. Till we bombard it with chemicals and poor thing, it becomes a cancer cell. Every organ knows what to do. And, you know, one of the other things that fascinates me, I'm a physicist, but I know that everything is not physics, you know. Life is not physics. In life, you do not have conservation of matter. You have the creation of matter. In physics, you have the conservation of matter and energy. In life, you can take a seed that tiny, and before you know it, you have a giant oak tree. You can take a coconut, and you have a coconut palm. Out of a tiny seed, you can grow far more biomass. then isn't that seed? Now, I have heard very often people justifying the application of chemical fertilizers with the justification, oh, you're taking out so much, therefore you should put that much. My God, can you imagine if you had to put the amount of toxic chemicals into the soil equal in mass to what you're pulling out? We'd be drowned in chemicals. In any case, most of what plants are is carbon. And what is applied as fertilizer is nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. The carbon the plants take for free from the atmosphere and recycle it for us. And in the recycling, they offer us a solution to climate change. Because climate change is a result of three kinds of greenhouse gases. The first is carbon dioxide that comes from burning fossil fuels. Industrial agriculture is 100% based on a fossil fuel system, including the nitrogen fertilizers that begin with fossil fuels. But nitrogen fertilizers also emit another greenhouse gas, and that greenhouse gas is nitrogen oxide. It's 300 times more damaging to the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. A third greenhouse gas is methane. The combination of this industrialization of farming and long-distance transport, where societies that have been able to grow their food are now being forced to import it from long distance, has translated into a system where today we're generating 40% of the climate problem from industrial agriculture and corporate farming, including the fact that as soya bean becomes the base, you know, of cattle feed, of oil, of everything, more and more land is going under soya. All of Argentina is today under Roundup-resistant soya. They spray from the air. No one can farm anything else because, as I mentioned, Roundup kills everything green. So if you want to be a vegetable gardener or an organic gardener, you can't do it anymore. It's one toxic landscape. The Amazon is being cut down for soya. We have reduced our food base from 8,500 crops to four crops that are genetically engineered and one or two other commodities, rice and wheat, which are also losing their life-giving aspect. And as more hunger is created, as more people are deprived of their access to food, hunger itself becomes the biggest market. There is, at this point, as I talk with you, a big fight going on, and it's about who will feed the malnourished. You know, people who can afford to buy food, go to Whole Foods, you go to a farmer's market, or you go to Walmart. And the more people lose jobs, the more they go to Walmart. And the argument is constantly used, cheap is good. But cheap, as I mentioned, is cheap because of the subsidies on the one hand and the monopoly buying on the other. If only one company will give you the seeds of tomato and buy back that tomato, tomato will be very cheap. If only one company will give you the seeds of cotton, and then you have monopolies in the trade in cotton, cotton will become cheaper than it cost to produce. On an average, the price of agricultural output is half of what it cost to produce. That's why it's cheap. Now, can you imagine if we had to do that with every system, where whatever you were producing, you were spending more on doing it than you were ever getting back from it? Now that there's so many hungry people, the 1 billion hungry children in the world, and 70% of India is severely malnourished, and the hunger in India grew while the economic growth grew. You know, while we were hitting 9% in terms of economic growth, more children in India were going hungry because the same processes that were leading to growth were leading to hunger. Everything that led to growth as its measure on the market, which is more trade and more commercial transaction, meant less food for children. So now you've got everyone who's made money destroying the health of people and creating malnutrition, jumping on a bandwagon, and offering solutions to hunger. So you've got something called GAIN. GAIN means profit, of course. But it's also called the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition. On this are Bayer, which is a toxic company, Coca-Cola, Dow AgroScience, Dow Chemical, DuPont, ExxonMobil, in the business of feeding babies food. Yeah. General Mills, Hershey Food, Kellogg, Kraft, McDonald's, Merck, Monsanto, Nestle, Novartis, PepsiCo, Pfizer, Procter & Gamble. And they've organized themselves in what they call International Life Sciences Institute. Now, we have a huge issue right now in India about this, because we are basically saying, first of all, that malnutrition is caused by denying communities and families the right to food. You've got to get back that right through the way you grow food, through food sovereignty. And there will be no hungry children. And where there are hungry children, if they have to be fed, the best, most secure source of both knowledge as well as provisioning are the women and mothers of the community. Both because they know how to use different foods better, and they're not going to turn their kids into a source of exploitation for profits. They will bring genuine nutrition to their kids. Let me give you an example of how messy this is becoming. They have floated something called a golden rice. It hasn't seen the market yet, but it's being tried on children. It's being tested on children. It's a genetically engineered rice that is supposed to get rid of blindness through vitamin A. Now, the vitamin A content in this rice was 34 micrograms for every 100 grams of food. The greens that women use in home gardens, in cooking, like our curry patta, dhania, all of that, 1,400 micrograms. Yeah? 1,400 versus 34, and this is supposed to increase vitamin A availability? I have called this the monoculture of the mind. You know, you don't have the capacity to see the diversity, you declare it doesn't exist, and then you bring an inferior toxic solution and say this is the only way. But it is linked to structures of power, and those structures of power are structures of capitalist patriarchy. They're structures that basically say capital has creativity, nature is dead, women don't produce. And they were getting away with that myth about the creativity of capital, that capital grows. Seeds don't grow. Gardens don't grow. Capital grows. And then they worked out derivatives and collateral debt obligations, and everything was growing till it collapsed. The growth on Wall Street was a fiction. And it is time now for us to turn to the real growth of food, the real growth of people, the real growth in an ecofeminist paradigm where people and things grow, not money, not power, not domination, not exploitation. How do we deal with these multifaceted aspects of a world food crisis? Because it is now a world crisis. Earlier it used to be pockets. It was localized. Now it's all integrated, so it becomes a ripple effect across the world. I, of course, began to find solutions by saving seeds, building Navdanya. We have 53 community seed banks in different parts of the country where farmers save seeds, can take it, just like in a bank, you can come, go take. And we don't charge money. We just ask a farmer to either return us twice the seed or give it to two farmers more. And that's how, in the areas where we work, there is no indebtedness. There are no farmer suicides. Farmers are earning 10 times more than farmers growing chemical food or GM crops. The organic training is the second part we do. But because after you've grown all these wonderful things and we've kind of brought biodiversity back into the diet, we have a program called Forgotten Foods. And the program of Forgotten Foods is totally women-led because only women know how to cook, use, eat forgotten foods. Women above 50. And so we also run on a little school I've started. It's called the School of the Seed, the Beach Vidya Peet, and we offer courses at the school. When I go back home, I will go straight into a course we are running, which is called the Grandmother's University. Because, you know, we've got a choice now between letting Monsanto tell us what's good for us or letting our grandmothers tell us what's good for us. And I would rather put my trust in our grandmothers. That's what we do in India. It's the same work we have to do all over the world. we have a convergence of multiple crises. We've got the financial crisis. Suddenly, the idea of jobs based on money is disappearing as fast as the money itself is. And I noticed in my travels over that USA Today had an article that there's been a doubling of bartering. That's how economies used to run. They used to be barter economies. We were told we are primitive. You know, we shouldn't exchange things amongst neighbors. We should do one thing, sell it to someone we don't know, and then buy whatever we need. Sad thing about that kind of economy is people lose at both ends. The producers lose because they've stopped being economically self-reliant. The consumers lose because they move constantly into a downward spiral of bad food, toxic food, lethal food. Nobody is gaining out of this except Monsanto, Cargill, whose profits went up last year even as the food scarcity increased. Their profits doubled. Monsanto increased the price of corn from $200 for seed corn from $200 a bag to $300 a bag. Seed will need to be saved and distributed in this country too. Seed savers will have to become the backbone of local economies. I know the organic movement is spreading, but the last generation of the organic movement was based on the assumption that the better of people can buy a slightly more expensive product. The new generation of the organic movement will have to be based on the recognition, first and foremost, that organic will only work to the extent it's local to offer an environmental solution. Because you remember the 40% problem from industrial globalized agriculture? Well, there's a 40% solution in local ecological agriculture. The second very important issue is, you know, my son decided to become a photographer, but all, you know, all people of his generation I knew thought the place for deliverance was the financial markets. They all made a beeline for Citibank, and which was the one that went under? Lehman Brothers and AIG, and not going to be the future. We call them the dinosaurs of the last century. And if the dinosaurs of the last century are not going to be our security, what is going to be our security? The earth. I think we have to shift radically in our understanding of sustainability, in our understanding of environmentalism. Earlier, environmentalism was something out there, you know, far away, a polar bear. Today's environmentalism will have to be rebuilding the natural capital that allows us to meet our needs on the one hand and generates livelihoods, jobs, and options for economic recovery on the other hand. It's the same actions we need for economic recovery as we do for solving the climate problem, as we do for addressing the food crisis. These are all interrelated crises. And small steps in building a local ecological food system are big steps in addressing these mega crises that we face. The wonderful thing this is doing is making food respectable again. Food was sort of an afterthought, you know, and every time I visit this country, I kind of get into a tizzy where everyone's walking with a cup of coffee and a burger in their hand and also trying to have a phone conversation, you know. I think the dignity that food deserves is going to be increasingly important. But the dignity that food producers deserve is going to be very important. And increasingly, the knowledge we thought we could forget, the knowledge that women have of how to save seeds, how to make a local food, how to preserve something without chemicals, that's only exclusively women's knowledge, because only women knew how to do preserving before the chemical age. So it's a time to celebrate the new task of recovery, a new task of recovery in which we become co-creators with nature and co-producers as a community. This will not begin with governments will always have a time lag of about 20 years. That's my life's experience. 20 years from now, they'll wake up to it, but we can't afford to wait 20 years. So we begin the work now, and let's do it. Thank you.
You have been listening to a program by Global Voices for Justice. This talk by Dr. Vandana Shiva on sustainability and the world food crisis was given at USC on March 9, 2009.
You can find out more about the audios and videos done by Voices for Global Justice on the web at voicesforglobaljustice.org.